Before that, though, I want to do a little advert, provided I can find my little bit of paper. Small groups are getting going again, and there's a new group which I want to mention to you in particular, which is different to the other groups that we have, and it's called Good Question. If you're one of those people who sometimes you think, I don't know what to say to people who ask me difficult questions, or something comes up in the news and you think, you know, what about that, you know, that hurricane in the Caribbean and what it's done to people? What about the floods in Nepal? How do I answer the people who say, why has God allowed that to happen? There aren't easy answers, are there? But we're starting this group for people who want to work together on learning to answer those questions better. It's not a course. It's not where you're going to be told all the answers. It's where you all, as a group, teach each other and learn and discover ways in which you can be more effective at talking with friends and answering questions. And it may be, as much as anything, that it answers some questions for you and helps you to become stronger in your faith and closer to the Lord. So if you're interested in that group, have a word with me. It's going to run for a year. It will run weekly. And there will be some opportunities to be able to share faith with other people through that group. So it's a practical group as well as a teaching group. We started a new series of sermons last week on the theme of worship, reverent worship. And I wonder what comes into your mind when you think worship. For some people, it will be sung worship and they'll think of singing. For other people, it will be liturgy, and they'll think of liturgy. And there are often people who say, look, come on, worship's not just about what happens in here. Worship's about what happens out there. And we talked about that last week, didn't we? About being living sacrifices. Well, today we're going to be thinking again about worship under the heading of a covenant people, because worship is not just an individual thing. Worship is something which we do together as God's people. Some people talk about three dimensions of worship. There's one dimension which is toward God. We worship God, obviously. There's another dimension which is about each other, where we worship together with each other in God's family. And there's a third dimension which is worship out there, worship every day, worship in the whole of our lives with other people. No one dimension captures the whole thing, but together we get a fuller picture of what worship is. And Paul, in this passage in Romans chapter 12, has been talking about whole life worship. But the reading we had, first of all, was from Exodus. And you may think, why only read half of the Ten Commandments? You know, is this, you know, are we going down the tubes? You know, are we just ignoring half of them and thinking that half of them are all right? It's a bit like, you know, years ago, there was a Reader's Digest Bible, you know, condensed Bible, and some people thought that maybe there would be five commandments and things like that, where it was all reduced. Well, it's not that. But the interesting thing about those first five commandments is that they are directed to our behavior towards God. But then the reading we just had from Romans chapter 12 is in two sections, and the first part is about the direction of our fellowship together, our Christian fellowship, our churches. And the third section, the second section rather, the last part from verse 17, is about our life out there, our behavior out there, how we treat people out there, how we live for Christ in the world out there. So that's what we're going to look at this morning. But in Romans chapter 12, verse 5, Paul says this: in Christ, we, though many, form one body, and each member belongs to all the others. And that's the core of this. That's the context of our worship, that we form one body. We are not individuals who come together and sit as far away from each other or as close to each other as we can. We form one body. We are the body of Christ, and each member belongs to all the others. And this is something that comes up elsewhere in Paul's writings. So, who was he writing to? Well, he was writing to a church in Rome, and I wonder whether you've ever wondered what that church might have been like. Was it like Highfield Church? Almost certainly not like Highfield Church. Nothing like Highfield Church, in fact. I don't know whether you've been to Pompeii, but Pompeii is fascinating in terms of getting a picture of what Roman life was like. there was running water, there were sewers, there were toilets, much earlier than in Highfield. There were there was takeaway food, all kinds of things there. And it gives you a fascinating glimpse as to what Rome was like, even though Pompeii was not quite the same as Rome. But by putting together what has been found in Rome with what has been found in Pompeii, it's been possible to get a better picture of what a church in Rome would have been like. And this terrific book, which if you have a problem sleeping, this will really help, is very detailed but very interesting as well. And it gives a description of what a house church in Rome might have been like and who might have been in a house church. Now, you might like to compare this with what you know of Highfield Church or another church that you know, or even your small group. This church might have had 30 people in it. That's based on the size of the apartments in Rome. Might have had 30 people, comprising a craft worker who rents a fairly large workshop and some separate living accommodation. His wife, children, a couple of male craft working slaves, a female domestic slave, a dependent relative. That's the core, perhaps, of the group. A few other householders, mainly but not necessarily all male, who rent less space from the householder above, some but not all of their spouses, children, slaves, and other dependents. Their rented spaces would be either workshops with a mezzanine living area or an apartment on an upper floor of an apartment block. A couple of members of families whose householder is not part of the house church, someone whose wife is not a believer, someone whose husband is not a believer. A couple of slaves whose owners are not part of the house church. A couple of free or freed dependents of people who are not part of the house church. A couple of homeless people. And a few people who are renting space in shared rooms. For example, migrant workers separated from their families or students in houses of multiple occupation. That's the kind of mix that was in this house church in Rome. And if you just keep that in mind, it may just illuminate what Paul says to them about living for Christ, about demonstrating love, about being God's people. You know, it's very easy, isn't it, to talk about love and say, yes, we've got to be a loving church. And often it's very sort of vague and sort of, sounds good. You can't argue with it, really, can you? You know, it's like motherhood and apple pie. Of course a church should be loving. But what does it mean in practice? And Paul is utterly practical here in the way that he spells out what love means within the church. How many of you will admit or claim or rejoice in being a lists person? Put your hand up. Are you a lists person? You write lots of lists. These passages are for you. These are long lists. And if you like reading lists, go over and over and over them. They're terrible things for preachers, though. How do you preach from a list? That's the challenge this morning. So let's have a look at these two lists in Romans 12. So there are a number of fairly detailed examples of what working out love in the church might be. First of all, Paul writes about sincerity. Love must be sincere. The word he uses, it's rooted in the word, the same word as hypocrisy. It's the idea of an actor with a mask. That was hypocrisy, that you put a mask on. It's not the real you. It's not what you really like. And Paul says that we must be sincere. Now, isn't it easy in church to put on an air of love, to put on an illusion? We can be very nice in church on a Sunday morning. How many? I'm not going to ask you to put your hand up, but I wonder how many people had just a little disagreement about anything on the way to church this morning? Probably not. None of you would, I know. And often it's only people with children and small children have a row with the children on the way to church. But you know, when we get to church, and you would never know, would you? Thankfully, it's appropriate that we behave in that way. But our love must be genuinely sincere. But it must also be discerning. And that's sometimes the problem with love, that it doesn't have any discernment to it. It's not about accepting everything. It's not about simply rolling over and being nice. It's about discernment. Verse 10, verse 9 rather, hate what is evil, cling to what is good. There's no contradiction between being a loving community and hating what is evil and clinging to what is good. They go together. Affection for one another, that's not a word we often use in church. Affection for one another. But that's what Paul is talking about when he says, be devoted to one another in love. It's the same word that might apply to blood relationships, but applied in the church. You know, I wonder how we see each other. Do we see each other as, are we like distant relatives? Are we like people who are close? Do we feel a genuine affection for each other? That's what Paul meant when he said, be devoted to one another in love and honor one another above yourselves. Now, we live in a very egalitarian society, don't we, where equality is the name of the game. We're not supposed to have any sort of hierarchies. Don't you believe it, but that's the theory. Anyway, no hierarchies. Well, the Romans certainly did have hierarchies and certainly weren't embarrassed about them and weren't wanting to get rid of them. So Paul's statement to honor one another above yourselves is completely radical. It's completely challenging them. Their normal thing would be to have a hierarchy. It's like the old John Cleese sketch, isn't it? You know, I'm middle class, I'm upper class, he's middle class, I'm lower class. You know, it's the sort of, we still have those hierarchies, though we don't often talk about them, but it's certainly like that in Rome. And Paul says, honor one another. There's a mutuality about it. He tells them that they need to keep the pot boiling as well. He says, verse 11, never be lacking in zeal. Never be lacking in zeal. Keep your spiritual fervor serving the Lord. Do you run out of puff as a Christian? Isn't it easy to do that? It's hard to keep going, isn't it? There are times when we just think, oh, I just want to forget about this for a bit and just switch off and be me. And Paul says, no, don't let that happen. Don't let the pot stop boiling. Don't let the flame go out. But keep your spiritual zeal. It's one of the things we can do for each other. One of the ways we can serve each other to stay alive as Christians. To stay effective. To be zealous. To be enthusiastic. This is a famous prayer. Lord, make me patient, but not yet. And patience is something which Paul talks about here. But he puts it in a different context. Verse 12, he says, be joyful in hope, patient in affliction, faithful in prayer. Patience is grounded in hope. It's hard to be patient if you don't have any hope. But if you have genuine hope that whenever it will be, and it may not be immediately, something will change. It's like, you know, the old film about the old people's home in India. And there's a line in there where he said, it will be all right in the end, and if it's not all right, it's not the end. And it's a bit like that sometimes, isn't it, here? This is the hope. It may not be all right now, but we have a hope. We have a hope which goes beyond the end, actually, which takes us into eternity, into the future. That hope is something which can sustain us, which can help us to be patient. Be joyful in hope, patient in affliction, faithful in prayer. They go together. It's hard to keep praying if you don't have any hope. Tom Wright's terrific book, Surprised by Hope, just really opened up the whole thing about the future for me, to give me a fresh hope. And, you know, we hear lots of bad news. We have friends with sad things happening to them. But in the end, there is a hope. There's a hope in Christ. Things will change. He talks in verse 14 about goodwill to other people. Bless those who persecute you. Bless and do not curse. Is there anything more counterintuitive than that? Can you imagine anything more counterintuitive for slaves in Rome? to bless those who persecute you, for Christians suffering at the hand of Nero and others. Bless those who persecute you. Of course, Paul wasn't original here. He was only echoing what the Lord Jesus himself said. But bless those who persecute you. Bless and do not curse. Now, of course, we don't ever curse people, do we? In fact, we probably don't even get persecuted in that sense. But what about the people who do make life difficult? What about the people who do give us a hard time? What about the people who irritate us, if we'll admit to being irritated? Do we bless them or do we persecute them? Do we do anything different as a result of being a Christian? I have a confession. Sometimes when I'm driving, I see someone throw something out of the window, maybe a cigarette or a packet or a sweet paper or maybe even a whole box of McDonald's or something like that. And I have this ambition one day just to stop at the traffic lights to pick it up, to throw it back in and say, you've lost something. I haven't got the courage to do it because I'm sure it would end up in violence probably. But that's not what Paul's talking about here. It's the opposite. He says, you know, the people who do bad things to you, you need to deal with that by blessing them. Verse 13, he talks about generosity. Share with the Lord's people who are in need. Practice hospitality. Hospitality in the ancient world wasn't inviting someone around for tea. Hospitality in the ancient world was taking somebody in for the night. Not many safe places to stay overnight. In fact, often people would carry with them a reference from somebody else saying, they're a safe person to have in your house. Yeah, you can take them in. It's all right. And Christians here are encouraged particularly to show hospitality to other Christians. I wonder if that's even something to do with what Paul on another time talked about, which was a letter of commendation, where something came from other Christians to say, this person's all right. They're safe to have. That's the kind of hospitality that Paul talks about here. He talks about sympathy, even empathy, verse 15. Rejoice with those who rejoice. Mourn with those who mourn. You've gone through a hard time sometime and thought, I can't see the point of this. What does it mean? Why does God let this happen to me? And it's just painful. It's difficult. And then sometime in the future, someone comes to you with another issue in their life. And you perhaps begin to see the connection between what you went through and what they're going through. And you can say, well, no, I know how you feel. Isn't that the worst thing to say to somebody? And isn't that the worst thing for somebody to say to you? I know how you feel. No, you don't know how I feel. But maybe you can say, actually, I've got an idea what it might feel like because I've been through something like that. That's what our experience can be redeemed to give us that. But to have the sympathy, to rejoice with those who rejoice and to mourn with those who mourn. To live in harmony with each other, to be of the same mind. Not to be proud, but to be willing to associate with those, with people of low position. Do not be conceited. I find this hard to admit, but I'm sure it's true if I look at myself. Do I have a hierarchy? Are there certain sorts of people who I'm interested in, other people who I'm not interested in? Are there some people I'm very happy to go and talk to them, and other people I sort of look in the other direction or don't even register that they're there? Paul says, humility. Live in harmony with one another. Don't be proud, but be willing to associate with people of low position. Consider others better than yourselves, he says in the first part of the chapter. So that's our life as Christians. What about our life in the wider community? Well, we've already talked about blessing those who persecute us, not cursing them. Verse 17, he says, but not retaliating. Don't repay anyone with evil for evil. Do you have that little internal conversation with yourself sometimes when something difficult happens? And after you've gone away, you start thinking what you should have said, what I wish I'd said. Why didn't I think of that to say that? I could have put them down. I could have shown them what was what. And you got away, and your mind gets all caught up with this imaginary thing, which you didn't say anyway. Well, maybe it's just as well you didn't say it. But Paul says here, don't retaliate like that. Retaliate. Do what's right, verse 17. Be careful to do what's right in the eyes of everyone. You know, we don't aim to just please people, but some people seem to go out of their way to not please people. And really what Paul is saying here is, look, where we can, we do what's right in a way that will please other people. That will, and in fact, he takes it further and he says that we live at peace with everyone as far as you can. As far as it's up to you. Now, sometimes we don't have any choice. Other people do things which make it very difficult to live at peace with them. We may be at peace with them, but they're not at peace with us. Neighbour disputes. Ever had neighbour disputes? Can't they be so difficult? And we don't want them, but somebody comes along and does something difficult. And it's very hard to live at peace with them. We had somebody who dug up part of our hedge once because they didn't like it. And you think, what do you do with that? What do you do with that? What's the Christian thing to do? Well, live at peace with everyone. And really the answer is in verse 19, where it says, do not take revenge, my dear friends. Do not take revenge, but leave room for God's wrath. See, that's where our security is. This is why a just God is so important to us. There is justice in the world. There is justice in the world. And we are not the ones who have to do all the just things. We can trust God because he is the one who is just and can say, it is mine to avenge. I will repay. On the contrary, for us, we to do the opposite. If your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he's thirsty, give him something to drink. And in doing this, you will heap burning coals on his head. Don't be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. Don't be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. Wouldn't it be great if nations thought that way? Overcome evil with good. Simplistic. So simplistic, but what difference would it make if we aim to overcome evil with good? I don't know. I always was a bit simplistic, really, but certainly on a personal level. Don't be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. Well, all of this, these lists sound quite impossible, don't they? Quite onerous. And you perhaps came to church this morning thinking, oh, I just want some encouragement. Had a hard week. Been tough, and I've got another tough week ahead, even worse. And all I get is this list of things I've got to do that half of them made me feel guilty anyway, and the other half I ought to feel guilty about. So what am I going to do with it? Well, let's just go back to the beginning of chapter 12, where Paul says, I urge you, brothers and sisters, in view of God's mercy. What do you know of God's mercy? How has God treated you? How has God dealt with you? What has God given to you that you don't deserve, that you never did deserve, that you can't deserve, and yet is part of your life, part of his faithfulness to you? You may know one bit of Lamentations, if you know anything at all, and this may be the only bit that you know. But this lovely verse from Lamentations chapter 3, because of the Lord's great love, we are not consumed. Because of the Lord's great love, we are not consumed. I often look at that verse and I think, you know, without God's love, what state would I be in? What would be my hope? What would be my future if it wasn't for God's love, for God's mercy, for God's grace? But because of the Lord's great love, we are not consumed, even if we deserve it. For his compassions, his mercies, they never fail. They're new every morning. They don't even run out. There's a constant supply of God's mercies, God's compassions. They're new every morning. Great is your faithfulness. That's the reason for us to live in this way. Because we are those who have received God's mercy. We have received God's grace. And we can show that to other people. So where has this left you this morning? Has this left you with an even bigger guilt trip? Has it twisted the knife a little bit, leaving you thinking, actually, I don't like that about myself. I really ought to do something about it. And I was trying to forget about it. And then we come along here and we have to be reminded about it in church. Where does it leave you? Well, I suspect most of us have got a long list of things here that we probably wish we could do something about. Maybe we are trying to do something about. What I want you to encourage you to do, though, is just in the quietness now, to look again at those two sections. Is there one thing in particular about your attitude and behavior to other Christians that the Lord is wanting to do something with, the Lord is wanting to change, the Lord is wanting to speak to you about? Is there something about the way you look at the wider community and the people around you that the Lord is challenging and wants to do something about? Take a moment to think about that before the Lord. And sometime today, why not share that with a friend, a good friend, someone you can trust? Maybe email somebody, maybe phone them, maybe talk to them. You may even want to pray with the prayer team at the end of the service. But just take the opportunity to do something concrete with that. Not to go away feeling guilty about all these things, but to take something that you really would like the Lord to help you to work on this week, to take into your life. Let's just be quiet for a moment and look at that passage again.